a frank and honest man, when the need is for a devious one. I will manage to be devious, if I must. Please don't underestimate me, Ilar. Ilar shrugged hopelessly. Very well. I can only argue with you up to a certain point. In fact, Ilar, I wish you had not postponed the meeting. I would rather skip my birthday and see the general than the reverse. This birthday celebration was not my idea. His voice died away in a grumble. Ilar said, I'm sorry. Well, said Selden with resignation, we'll see what happens. He turned and left. Sometimes he wished ardently that he could run what was called a tight ship, making sure that everything went as he wished it to, leaving little or no room for maneuvering among his subordinates. To do that, however, would take enormous time, enormous effort, would deprive him of any chance of working on psychohistory himself. And besides, he simply lacked the temperament for it. He sighed. He would have to speak to Amaryl. Chapter 10. Selden strode into Amaryl's office unannounced. Hugo, he said abruptly, the session with General Tenar has been postponed. He seated himself in a rather pettish manner. It took Amaryl his usual few moments to disconnect his mind from his work. Looking up finally, he said, What was his excuse? It wasn't he. Some of our mathematicians arranged a week's postponement so that it wouldn't interfere with the birthday celebration. I find all of this to be extremely annoying. Why did you let them do that? I didn't. They just went ahead and arranged things. Selden shrugged. In a way, it's my fault. I've whined so long about turning 60 that everyone thinks they have to cheer me up with festivities. Amaryl said, Of course we can use the week. Selden sat forward, immediately tense. Is something wrong? No, not that I can see, but it won't hurt to examine it further. Look, Harry, this is the first time in nearly 30 years that psychohistory has reached the point where it can actually make a prediction. It's not much of one, it's just a small pinch of the vast continent of humanity, but it's the best we've had so far. All right, we want to take advantage of that, see how it works. Prove to ourselves that psychohistory is what we think it is, a predictive science. So it won't hurt to make sure that we haven't overlooked anything. Even this tiny bit of prediction is complex, and I welcome another week of study. Very well, then. I'll consult you on the matter before I go to see the general for any last-minute modifications that have to be made. Meanwhile, Hugo, do not allow any information concerning this to leak out to the others, not to anyone. If it fails, I don't want the people of the project to grow downhearted. You and I will absorb the failure ourselves and keep on trying. A rare, wistful smile crossed Amaryl's face. You and I. Do you remember when it really was just the two of us? I remember it very well, and don't think that I don't miss those days. We didn't have much to work with. Not even the prime radiant, let alone the electroclarifier. But those were happy days. Happy, said Amaryl, nodding his head. Chapter 11. The university had been transformed, and Harry Selden could not refrain from being pleased. The central rooms of the project complex had suddenly sprouted in color and light, with holography filling the air with shifting three-dimensional images of Selden at different places and different times. There was Doris Venabile smiling, looking somewhat younger. Rach as a teenager, still unpolished. Seldon and Amaryl, looking unbelievably young, bent over their computers. There was even a fleeting sight of Ato Demerzel, which filled Seldon's heart with yearning for his old friend and the security he had felt before Demerzel's departure. The Emperor Cleon appeared nowhere in the holographics. It was not because holographs of him did not exist, but it was not wise under the rule of the junta to remind people of the past Imperium. It all poured outward, overflowing, filling room after room, building after building. Somehow, time had been found to convert the entire university into a display the likes of which Seldon had never seen or even imagined. Even the dome lights were darkened to produce an artificial night against which the university would sparkle for 3 days. 3 days? Said Seldon, half impressed, half horrified. 3 days, said Doris Van Abbeley, nodding her head. The university would consider nothing less. The expense, the labor, said Seldon, frowning. The expense is minimal, said Doris, compared to what you have done for the university. And the labor is all voluntary. The students turned out and took care of everything. A from-the-air view of the university appeared now, panoramically, and Seldon stared at it with a smile forcing itself onto his countenance. Doris said, You're pleased. You've done nothing but grouse these past few months about how you didn't want any celebration for being an old man, and now look at you. Well, it is flattering. I had no idea that they would do anything like this. Why not? You're an icon, Harry. The whole world, the whole empire knows about you. They do not, said Seldon, shaking his head vigorously. Not one in a billion knows anything at all about me, and certainly not about psychohistory. No one outside the project has the faintest knowledge of how psychohistory works, and not everyone inside does either. That doesn't matter, Harry. It's you. Even the quadrillions who don't know anything about you or your work know that Harry Seldon is the greatest mathematician in the Empire. Well, said Seldon, looking around, they certainly are making me feel that way right now. But 3 days and 3 nights, the place will be reduced to splinters. No, it won't. All the records have been stored away. The computers and other equipment have been secured. The students have set up a virtual security force that will prevent anything from being damaged. You've seen to all of that, haven't you, Doris? Said Seldon, smiling at her fondly. A number of us have. It's by no means all me. Your colleague Tamwell Ilar has worked with incredible dedication. Seldon scowled. What's the matter with Ilar? Said Doris. Seldon said, He keeps calling me Maestro. Doris shook her head. Well, there's a terrible crime. Seldon ignored that and said, And he's young. Worse and worse. Come, Harry, you're going to have to learn to grow old gracefully, and to begin with, you'll have to show that you're enjoying yourself. That will please others and increase their enjoyment, and surely you would want to do that. Come on, move around. Don't hide here with me. Greet everyone. Smile. Ask after their health. And remember that after the banquet, you're going to have to make a speech. I dislike banquets, and I doubly dislike speeches. You'll have to anyway. Now move. Seldon sighed dramatically and did as he was told. He cut quite an imposing figure as he stood in the archway leading into the main hall. The voluminous First Minister's robes of yesteryear were gone, as were the Heliconian-style garments he had favored in his youth. Now Selden wore an outfit that bespoke his elevated status. Straight pants, crisply pleated, a modified tunic on top. Embroidered in silver thread above his heart was the insignia Selden Psychohistory Project at Streeling University. It sparkled like a beacon against the dignified titanium-gray hue of his clothing. Selden's eyes twinkled in a face now lined by age, his 60 years given away as much by his wrinkles as by his white hair. He entered the room in which the children were feasting. The room had been entirely cleared, except for trestles with food upon them. The children rushed up to him as soon as they saw him, knowing as they did that he was the reason for the feast, and Selden tried to avoid their clutching fingers. "Wait, wait, children," he said. "Now, stand back." He pulled a small computerized robot from his pocket and placed it on the floor. In an empire without robots, this was something that he could expect to be eye-popping. It had the shape of a small furry animal, but it also had the capacity to change shapes without warning, eliciting squeals of children's laughter each time. And when it did so, the sounds and motions it made changed as well. "Watch it," said Selden, "and play with it, and try not to break it. Later on, there'll be one for each of you." He slipped out into the hallway leading back to the main hall, and realized as he did so that Wanda was following him.
"Grandpa," she said.
Well, of course, Wanda was different. He swooped down and lifted her high in the air, turned her over, and put her down. "Are you having a good time, Wanda?" he asked.
"Yes," she said. "But don't go into that room."
"Why not, Wanda? It's my room. It's the office where I work."
"It's where I had my bad dream."
"I know, Wanda, but that's all over, isn't it?" He hesitated, then he led Wanda to one of the chairs lining the hallway. He sat down and placed her in his lap. "Wanda," he said, "are you sure it was a dream?"
"I think it was a dream."
"Were you really sleeping?"
"I think I was."
She seemed uncomfortable talking about it, and Selden decided to let it go. There was no use pushing her any further. He said, "Well, dream or not, there were two men, and they talked of lemonade death, didn't they?" Wanda nodded reluctantly. Selden said, "You're sure they said lemonade?" Wanda nodded again. "Might they have said something else, and you thought they said lemonade?"
"Lemonade is what they said."
Selden had to be satisfied with that. "Well, run off and have a good time, Wanda. Forget about the dream."
"All right, Grandpa."
She cheered up as soon as the matter of the dream was dismissed, and off she went to join the festivities. Selden went to search for Manella. It took him an extraordinarily long time to find her, since at every step he was stopped, greeted, and conversed with. Finally, he saw her in the distance, muttering,
pardon me, there's someone I must, pardon me.
He worked his way over to her with considerable trouble. "Manella," he said, and drew her off to one side, smiling mechanically in all directions.
"Yes, Harry," she said. "Is something wrong?"
"It's Wanda's dream."
"Don't tell me she's still talking about it."
"Well, it's still bothering her. Listen, we have lemonade at the party, haven't we?" "A
Of course. The children adore it. I've added a couple of dozen different mycogenian taste buds to very small glasses of different shapes, and the children try them one after the other to see which taste best. The adults have been drinking it, too. I have. Why don't you taste it, Harry? It's great. I'm thinking. If it wasn't a dream, if the child really heard two men speak of lemonade death... He paused as though ashamed to continue. Manella said, Are you thinking that someone poisoned the lemonade? That's ridiculous. By now, every child in the place would be sick or dying. I know, muttered Selden. I know. He wandered off and almost didn't see Doris when he passed her. She seized his elbow. Why the face? She said. You look concerned. I've been thinking of Wanda's lemonade death. So have I, but I can't make anything of it so far. I can't help but think of the possibility of poisoning. Don't. I assure you that every bit of food that came into this party has been molecularly checked. I know you'll think that's my typical paranoia, but my task is guarding you, and that is what I must do. And everything is... No poison, I promise you. Selden smiled. Well, good. That's a relief. I didn't really think... Let's hope not, said Doris dryly. What concerns me far more than this myth of poison is that I have heard that you're going to be seeing that monster Tenar in a few days. Don't call him a monster, Doris. Be careful. We're surrounded by ears and tongues. Doris immediately lowered her voice. I suppose you're right. Look around. All these smiling faces, and yet... Who knows which of our friends will be reporting back to the head and his henchmen when the night is over? Ah, humans, even after all these thousands of centuries, to think that such base treachery still exists. It seems to me to be so unnecessary, yet I know the harm it can do. That is why I must go with you, Harry. Impossible, Doris. It would just complicate matters for me. I'll go myself, and I'll have no trouble. You would have no idea how to handle the general. Selden looked grave. And you would? You sound exactly like Ilar. He too is convinced that I am a helpless old fool. He too wants to come with me, or rather to go in my place. I wonder how many people on Trantor are willing to take my place. He added with clear sarcasm. Dozens? Millions? Chapter 12 For 10 years, the Galactic Empire had been without an emperor, but there was no indication of that fact in the way the Imperial Palace grounds were operated. Millennia of custom made the absence of an emperor meaningless. It meant, of course, that there was no figure in imperial robes to preside over formalities of one sort or another. No imperial voice gave orders. No imperial wishes made themselves known. No imperial gratifications or annoyances made themselves felt. No imperial pleasures warmed either palace. No imperial sicknesses cast them in gloom. The Emperor's own quarters in the small palace were empty. The Imperial family did not exist. And yet the army of gardeners kept the grounds in perfect condition. An army of service people kept the buildings in top shape. The Emperor's bed, never slept in, was made with fresh sheets every day. The rooms were cleaned. Everything worked as it always worked. And the entire Imperial staff, from top to bottom, worked as they had always worked. The top officials gave commands as they would have done if the Emperor had lived.
commands that they knew the emperor would have given. In many cases, in particular in the higher echelons, the personnel were the same as those who had been there on Cleon's last day of life. The new personnel who had been taken on were carefully molded and trained into the traditions they would have to serve. It was as though the empire, accustomed to the rule of an emperor, insisted on this ghost rule to hold the empire together. The junta knew this, or if they didn't, they felt it vaguely. In 10 years, none of those military men who had commanded the empire had moved into the emperor's private quarters in the small palace. Whatever these men were, they were not imperial, and they knew they had no rights there. A populace that endured the loss of liberty would not endure any sign of irreverence to the emperor, alive or dead. Even General Tenar had not moved into the graceful structure that had housed the emperors of a dozen different dynasties for so long. He had made his home and office in one of the structures built on the outskirts of the grounds. Eyesores, but eyesores that were built like fortresses, sturdy enough to withstand a siege, with outlying buildings in which an enormous force of guards was housed. Tenar was a stocky man, with a mustache. It was not a vigorous, overflowing, doll-like mustache, but one that was carefully clipped and fitted to the upper lip, leaving a strip of skin between the hair and the line of the lip. It was a reddish mustache, and Tenar had cold blue eyes. He had probably been a handsome man in his younger days, but his face was pudgy now, and his eyes were slits that expressed anger more often than any other emotion. So he said angrily, as one would who felt himself to be absolute master of millions of worlds, and yet who dared not call himself an emperor, to Hender Lin, "I can establish a dynasty of my own." He looked around with a scowl. "This is not a fitting place for the master of the empire." Lin said softly, "To be master is what is important. Better to be a master in a cubicle than a figurehead in a palace." "Best yet, to be master in a palace. Why not?" Lin bore the title of colonel, but it is quite certain that he had never engaged in any military action. His function was that of telling Tenar what he wanted to hear, and of carrying his orders unchanged to others. On occasion, if it seemed safe, he might try to steer Tenar into more prudent courses. Lin was well known as Tenar's lackey, and knew that was how he was known. It did not bother him. As lackey, he was safe, and he had seen the downfall of those who had been too proud to be lackeys. The time might, of course, come when Tenar himself would be buried in the ever-changing junta panorama, but Lin felt, with a certain amount of philosophy, that he would be aware of it in time and save himself. Or he might not. There was a price for everything. "No reason why you can't found a dynasty, General," said Lin. "Many others have done it in the long imperial history. Still, it takes time. The people are slow to adapt. It's usually only the second or even third of the dynasty who is fully accepted as emperor." "I don't believe that. I need merely announce myself as new emperor. Who will dare quarrel with that? My grip is tight." "So it is, General. Your power is unquestioned on Trantor and in most of the inner worlds. Yet it is possible that many in the farther outer worlds will not, just yet, accept a new imperial dynasty."
"Inner worlds or outer worlds, military force rules all. That is an old imperial maxim."
"And a good one," said Lin. "But many of the provinces have armed forces of their own nowadays that they may not use on your behalf. These are difficult times."
"You counsel caution, then?
I always counsel caution, General.
And someday you may counsel it once too often. Lin bent his head.
I can only counsel what seems to me to be good and useful to you, General.
As in your constant harping to me about this Harry Seldon.
He is your greatest danger, General.
So you keep saying, but I don't see it. He's just a college professor.
Lin said, so he is, but he was once first minister.
I know, but that was in Cleon's time. Has he done anything since? With times being difficult, and with the governors of the provinces being fractious, why is a professor my greatest danger?
It is sometimes a mistake, said Lin carefully, for one had to be careful in educating the general, to suppose that a quiet, unobtrusive man can be harmless. Seldon has been anything but harmless to those he has opposed. 20 years ago, the Joranumite movement almost destroyed Cleon's powerful First Minister, Ato Demerzel.
Tenar nodded, but the slight frown on his face betrayed his effort to remember the matter.
It was Seldon who destroyed Joranum and who succeeded Demerzel as First Minister. The Joranumite movement survived, however, and Seldon engineered its destruction too, but not before it succeeded in bringing about the assassination of Cleon.
But Seldon survived that, didn't he?
You are perfectly correct. Seldon survived.
That is strange. To have permitted an imperial assassination should have meant death for a first minister.
So it should have. Nevertheless, the junta has allowed him to live. It seemed wiser to do so.
Why?
Lin sighed internally. There is something called psychohistory, General.
I know nothing about that, said Tenar flatly.
Actually, he had a vague memory of Lin trying to talk to him on a number of occasions concerning this strange collection of syllables. He had never wanted to listen, and Lin had known better than to push the matter.
Tenar didn't want to listen now, either, but there seemed to be a hidden urgency in Lin's words.
Perhaps, Tenar thought, he had now better listen.
Almost no one knows anything about it, said Lin. Yet there are a few, intellectuals who find it of interest. And what is it?
It is a complex system of mathematics.
Tenar shook his head. Leave me out of that, please. I can count my military divisions. That's all the mathematics I need.
The story is, said Lin, that psychohistory may make it possible to predict the future.
The general's eyes bulged. You mean this Seldon is a fortune-teller?
Not in the usual fashion. It is a matter of science.
I don't believe it.
It is hard to believe, but Seldon has become something of a cult figure here on Trentor, and in certain places in the outer worlds. Now, psychohistory, if it can be used to predict the future, or if even people merely think it can be so used, can be a powerful tool with which to uphold the regime.
I'm sure you have already seen this, General.
One need merely predict our regime will endure and bring forth peace and prosperity for the Empire. People believing this will help make it a self-fulfilling prophecy. On the other hand, if Seldon wishes the reverse, he can predict civil war and ruin. People will believe that, too, and that would destabilize the regime.
In that case, Colonel, we simply make sure that the predictions of psychohistory are what we want them to be. It would be Selden who would have to make them, and he is not a friend of the regime. It is important, General, that we differentiate between the project that is working at Streeling University to perfect psychohistory and Harry Selden. Psychohistory can be extremely useful to us, but it will be so only if someone other than Selden were in charge.
Are there others who could be?
Oh, yes. It is only necessary to get rid of Selden.
What is so difficult with that? An order of execution, and it is done.
It would be better, General, if the government was not seen to be directly involved in such a thing.
Explain.
I have arranged to have him meet with you so that you can use your skill to probe his personality. You would then be able to judge whether certain suggestions I have in mind are worthwhile or not.
When is the meeting to take place?
It was to take place very soon, but his representatives at the project asked for a few days' leeway because they were in the process of celebrating his birthday, his 60th, apparently. It seemed wise to allow that and to permit a week's delay.
Why? Demanded Tenar. I dislike any display of weakness.
Quite right, General. Quite right. Your instincts are, as always, correct. However, it seemed to me that the needs of the state might require us to know what and how the birthday celebration, which is taking place right now, might involve.
Why?
All knowledge is useful. Would you care to see some of the festivities?
General Tenar's face remained dark. Is that necessary?
I think you will find it interesting, General. The reproduction, sight and sound, was excellent, and for quite a while the hilarity of the birthday celebration filled the rather stark room in which the General sat.
Lynn's low voice served as commentary. Most of this, General, is taking place in the project complex, but the rest of the university is involved. We will have an air view in a few moments, and you will see that the celebration covers a wide area. In fact, though I don't have the evidence available right now, there are corners of the planet, here and there in various university and sectoral settings mostly, where what we might call sympathy celebrations of one sort or another are taking place. The celebrations are still continuing, and will endure for another day at least.
Are you telling me that this is a Trantor-wide celebration?
In a specialized way. It affects mostly the intellectual classes, but it is surprisingly widespread. It may even be that there is some shouting on worlds other than Trantor.
Where did you get this reproduction?
Lynn smiled. Our facilities in the project are quite good. We have reliable sources of information, so that little can happen that doesn't come our way at once.
Well then, Lynn, what are all your conclusions about this?
It seems to me, General, and I'm sure that it seems so to you, that Harry Selden is the focus of a personality cult. He has so identified himself with psychohistory that if we were to get rid of him in too open a manner, we would entirely destroy the credibility of the science. It would be useless to us. On the other hand, General, Selden is growing old, and it is not difficult to imagine him being replaced by another man, someone we could choose, and who would be friendly to our great aims and hopes for the Empire. If Selden could be removed in such a way that it is made to seem natural, then that is all we need.
The General said, And you think I ought to see him?
Yes, in order to weigh his quality and decide what we ought to do. But we must be cautious, for he is a popular man.
I have dealt with popular people before, said Tenar darkly.
Chapter 13.
Yes, said Harry Seldon wearily. It was a great triumph. I had a wonderful time.
I can hardly wait until I'm 70 so I can repeat it. But the fact is, I'm exhausted.
So get yourself a good night's sleep, Dad, said Rach, smiling. That's an easy cure.
I don't know how well I can relax when I have to see our great leader in a few days.
Not alone you won't see him, said Doris Benevoli grimly.
Seldon frowned. Don't say that again, Doris. It is important for me to see him alone.
It won't be safe with you alone. Do you remember what happened 10 years ago when you refused to let me come with you to greet the gardeners?
There is no danger of my forgetting when you remind me of it twice a week, Doris. In this case, though, I intend to go alone. What can he want to do to me if I come in as an old man, utterly harmless, to find out what he wants?
What do you imagine he wants? Said Rach, biting at his knuckle.
I suppose he wants what Cleon always wanted. It will turn out that he has found out that psychohistory can in some way predict the future, and he will want to use it for his own purposes. I told Cleon the science wasn't up to it nearly 30 years ago, and I kept telling him that all through my tenure as First Minister. And now I'll have to tell General Tenar the same thing.
How do you know he'll believe you? Said Rach.
I'll think of some way of being convincing. Doris said,
I do not wish you to go alone.
Your wishing, Doris, makes no difference.
At this point, Temuel Ilar interrupted. He said, I'm the only non-family person here. I don't know if a comment from me would be welcome.
Go ahead, said Seldon. Come one, come all.
I would like to suggest a compromise. Why don't a number of us go with the maestro? Quite a few of us. We can act as his triumphal escort, a kind of finale to the birthday celebration. Now wait, I don't mean that we will all crowd into the general's offices. I don't even mean entering the Imperial Palace grounds. We can just take hotel rooms in the Imperial sector at the edge of the grounds. The Dome's Edge Hotel would be just right, and we'll give ourselves a day of pleasure.
That's just what I need, snorted Seldon. A day of pleasure.
Not you, Maestro, said Ilar at once. You'll be meeting with General Tenar. The rest of us, though, we'll give the people of the Imperial Sector a notion of your popularity, and perhaps the General will take note also. And if he knows we're all waiting for your return, it may keep him from being unpleasant.
There was a considerable silence after that. Finally, Rach said, It sounds too showy to me. It don't fit in with the image the world has of Dad.
But Doris said, I'm not interested in Harry's image. I'm interested in Harry's safety. It strikes me that if we cannot invade the General's presence or the Imperial grounds, then allowing ourselves to accumulate, so to speak, as near the General as we can, might do us well. Thank you, Dr. Ilar, for a very good suggestion.
I don't want it done, said Seldon.
But I do, said Doris. And if that's as close as I can get to offering you personal protection, then that much I will insist on.
Manella, who had listened to it all without comment till then, said,
Visiting the Dome's Edge Hotel could be a lot of fun.
It's not fun I'm thinking of, said Doris, but I'll accept your vote in favor.
And so it was.
The following day, some 20 of the higher echelon of the Psychohistory Project descended on the Dome's Edge Hotel, with rooms overlooking the open spaces of the Imperial Palace grounds. The following evening, Harry Seldon was picked up by the General's armed guards and taken off to the meeting. At almost the same time, Doris Van Eveli disappeared, but her absence was not noted for a long time. And when it was noted, no one could guess what had happened to her, and the gaily festive mood turned rapidly into apprehension. Chapter 14. Doris Van Eveli had lived on the Imperial Palace grounds for 10 years. As wife of the First Minister, she had entry to the grounds and could pass freely from the dome to the open, with her fingerprints as the pass. In the confusion that followed Cleon's assassination, her pass had never been removed. And now, when, for the first time since that dreadful day, she wanted to move from the dome into the open spaces of the grounds, she could do so. She had always known that she could do so easily only once, for upon discovery the pass would be cancelled. But this was the one time to do it. There was a sudden darkening of the sky as she moved into the open, and she felt a distinct lowering of the temperature. The world under the dome was always kept a little lighter during the night period than natural night would require, and was kept a little dimmer during the day period. And, of course, the temperature beneath the dome was always a bit milder than the outdoors. Most Trentorians were unaware of this, for they spent their entire lives under the dome. To Doris, it was expected, but it didn't really matter. She took the central roadway, into which the dome opened, at the site of the Dome's Edge Hotel. It was, of course, brightly lit, so that the darkness of the sky didn't matter at all. Doris knew that she would not advance 100 meters along the roadway without being stopped, less, perhaps, in the present paranoid days of the junta. Her alien presence would be detected at once. Nor was she disappointed. A small ground car skittered up, and the guardsman shouted out the window, "What are you doing here? Where are you going?" Doris ignored the question and continued to walk. The guardsman called out, "Halt!" Then he slammed on the brakes and stepped out of the car, which was exactly what Doris had wanted him to do. The guardsman was holding a blaster loosely in his hand, not threatening to use it, merely demonstrating its existence. He said, "Your reference number." Doris said, "I want your car." "What?" The guardsman sounded outraged. "Your reference number, immediately." And now the blaster came up. Doris said quietly, "You don't need my reference number." Then she walked toward the guardsman. The guardsman took a backward step. "If you don't stop and present your reference number, I'll blast you." "No. Drop your blaster." The guardsman's lips tightened. His finger began to edge toward the contact. But before he could reach it, he was lost. He could never describe afterward what happened in any accurate way. All he could say was, "How was I to know it was the Tiger Woman?"